Hi, folks. Sam Cedar here. I hope you're enjoying the free podcast that we provide every single day. I would say probably more free podcast goodness than any podcast that exists in everywhere. And but today I've got a special request for you. We have a survey. It's about five questions. You go to majority.fm. It links through. It is for our podcast provider. It will help us monetize the podcast so you can continue to get it free. You don't have to put your email in there if you don't want. It's five quick questions. It will take you literally 2 minutes. If you do that, you'll help us out, and it'll be greatly appreciated. Come on, do it as a Hanukkah present for me. All right, enjoy the show.
The Majority Report. Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 7th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Day 9 of my epic battle with this cold continues. Joining us on the program today to recap President Obama's speech yesterday in Atsama, I can't pronounce it.
Oh, look at that, man.
He had a speech yesterday. In a town where Teddy Roosevelt gave a speech. And Bill Scheer from Campaign for America's Future and Liberal Oasis. He's a self-proclaimed Obama bot, so I thought, who better than to talk about this speech? Also on the program, updates from yesterday's Occupy Our Homes action by Occupy Wall Street. We'll be talking to Abby Clark of Occupy Our Homes. And hopefully our guy Jeff Smith will call in. In fact, we encourage any calls from you are actually currently occupying a foreclosed home. Call in to the program. Later in the show, the number 646-257-3920. Some more stories on healthcare. Martha Coakley strikes back at GMAC. And frankly, the entire show today, we could not mention Occupy Wall Street once, but nearly every story that we have is a function of their existence and what they've done, whether I'm talking about Governor Cuomo doing a little bit of one of these when it comes to allowing the expiration of tax cuts for millionaires in this state of New York, whether we're talking about President Obama's speech in, how do I say it? Atsutami? Asatwami? Asatomi? It's a city in Kansas.
You're going to get a very angry call from someone who lives there.
Good. Good. I live my whole life here in Worcester, so they're just going to hear the big O. That's what they're. I'm going to call that. More stories as the show goes on. Jerry Nadler, New York City, wanting the Department of Justice to look into the behavior of the cops as they dealt with occupiers across the country. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bill Scherer. Oh, and you know, at one point, I'm going to read that email I got. It depressed me. From a former member. We were just a member for a month. It was annoying. But we'll get to that. Oh, this show is going to be so great today. We'll be back in a minute. Last night there were skinheads on my lawn. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Some people say that bowling alley's got big lanes.
Got big lanes, got big lanes.
Some people say that bowling alleys all look the same. Here that rhymes with anything.
Anything, anything.
Had a dream last night, but I forget what it was.
What it was, what it was.
Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling. Take the skinheads bowling, take them bowling.
After all that's happened, after the worst economic crisis, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression, they want to return to the same practices that got us into this mess. And their philosophy is simple. We are better off when everybody is left to fend for themselves and play by their own rules. I am here to say they are wrong.
All right, there you go. That was one of the comments or the elements of the speech President Obama gave in Kansas yesterday on the phone. The great Bill Scherer. Hello, Bill.
Hello, how are you today?
I'm doing great. How are
I'm
you?
I'm doing well myself.
Wow, you're already defensive.
Now, am I here in my Obama bot capacity?
Yeah. Well, I want to look. I mean, I figure who better, because I didn't know how to deal with the speech, because I thought the speech, for the most part, was a great speech. The only problem I had with it was the timing. I guess better late than never, but that's one of the better things I can say for it. But characterize the speech for me.
Well, I will. Just to preface, so if I'm here in my Obama capacity. I am not representing any organization that I have affiliations with. I'm speaking for myself only.
Yes. In fact, we would not even allow you to speak for any other organizations. You are here as liberaloasis.com.
Yes. I can speak for that fly-by operation.
Okay.
Look, I think that if you look at the trajectory of all Obama's rhetoric over the course of the last 3 years, he often pivots to more confrontational and pointed rhetoric when it's campaign season. And this is kind of more of an old school style of governing, that there's governing time and there's campaign time. And when it's governing time and you're trying to round up votes, you're trying to find every last vote you can, and maybe some of them are going to be Republican votes, then you dial down the pointedness of the rhetoric in the hopes of not alienating anybody. And some people question that tactic. They think they can get more votes by playing Smash Mouth, but that's not the way Obama has played it. But, you know, in 2010, when it was midterm election time, he gave some very tough speeches. And I think at this point, when they've gotten past sort of the basic governing work that they had to do, from their perspective, they had to avert a government shutdown, they had to raise a debt ceiling, they got past those things, and now they're looking at 2012 as being basically extended campaign season. They're going to have tougher rhetoric that's going to draw clearer lines between where the two parties stand. I think that's what you're seeing.
And he basically started this around Labor Day this year, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think after the debt ceiling debate was done, because once he had that super committee construct with the trigger, you know, I think he won the grand bargain, and people cannot like that. But I think he also knew that if he didn't get the grand bargain, it wasn't going to be calamitous because he had this trigger built in. It wasn't going to mean the debt ceiling doesn't rise or it's going to be a government shutdown. So he was freer to be more pointed in his rhetoric. And so I think you're going to see more and more of that as the campaign progresses. At the same time, you're probably not going to see a lot of legislation passed, for better or for worse, because that's not the objective right now. When the objective was getting legislation passed, you had a different rhetorical stance.
Now, wait a second. explain to me how we've averted, a fight over the budget, let's say. I mean, there seems to me there's a couple more hostage-taking opportunities, no?
Well, because they had in the last debt ceiling deal agreement about spending caps that Boehner at least seems to want to stick to, you have some rumblings in the Tea Party caucus that they should go below where those caps are and provoke another fight about, and that could cause a government shutdown if the Republican Party was going to be unified on that point. But Boehner has been telling his caucus, no, we made a deal. That deal is done, and we're gonna take it on the chin if we violate that. So I think you're theoretically correct. They could do something to blow these things up, but I don't think that Obama's expecting that to happen, and Boehner seems to be signaling that it's not going to happen.
So President Obama, it's not just also that we're seeing President Obama play a little smash mouth here. We're also seeing him pivot towards populism in a way that he hadn't, that wasn't manifested really in his administration ever, I guess. I mean, you know, this is a rhetorical populism. You know, we have yet to see really any legislation reflected in this way. So he's not, it's not just a question about being aggressive. It's also a question about populism. Should we believe it?
Well, this goes into the bigger question of how do you feel about the last 3 years, and more specifically the first 2 years of the Obama administration. Did he do good things or not? Was it a net positive or a net negative? I would argue that the Recovery Act and the Affordable Care Act and Dodd-Frank are examples of populism, are examples of fighting for the middle class. And there are folks who don't think that. They think that they're cop-outs and sellouts and nothing really has significantly changed. And that's sort of a big fundamental debate. I would argue that if you look at the sweep of liberal progressive reforms going back to FDR, this is maybe not equivalent to FDR and LBJ, but not that far off, and a heck of a lot better than the first 2 years of Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter. And considering the kind of political constraints he was under with the kind of majorities that he had, the nature of the Democratic Party, the nature of the Republican Party, I would say it's pretty darn impressive. Other people are going to take a different view of that, but I think you look at the whole sweep of the Obama administration, I think the rhetoric he's giving today is not some dramatic 180-degree pivot from what he's been trying to do this whole time.
I take a slightly different view, as you know. I think that one of the things that that's sort of left out of this calculation is sort of the opportunity that was available. Right. I mean, how do you account for that? I mean, I appreciate that President Obama is arguably been better than President Clinton, because, frankly, I can point to a lot of legislation that President Clinton did that. And I should also say, for the time being, let's leave things like civil liberties off the table, because I think President Obama is atrocious in that regard. But let's leave that off the table for a moment. I think President Clinton oversaw a tremendous amount of deregulation, whether it was in big media, whether it was in big finance. He really messed up our welfare system, I think. Based upon the opportunity that President Obama had, how do you reconcile that?
Well, I would argue that the opportunity was at least partially met, and certainly tried to have met as much as possible. That he took his first 2 years to say, let's get as much done as we can because the window might close on us. And I don't have the luxury to just fight about it. Let's lock some stuff in. Let's lock it as much as we can. And I think they pushed on approach every front they could. They got pushed back from a good chunk of the Democratic Party, unfortunately, which limited how much they could get. But I think he got what he wanted on the Affordable Care Act and probably on Dodd-Frank, too, as far as what he
on the stimulus, though. But don't we know that on the stimulus calculation, their calculation was actually the complete opposite of what you're suggesting? I mean, their idea was, well, if we need more, we can come back.
Yeah, I think there was that debate, and there was a concern, there was a political concern that if you push for more than a trillion, that you might get nothing, that you might get too much blowback. And that's a tough strategic call. And so I think it's fine to say that in retrospect, the Recovery Act wasn't as big as it should have been relative to the size of the hole in the economy. But it doesn't necessarily follow that if you merrily asked for more, that you would have automatically gotten it. The possibility does exist. They could have asked for $1.2 trillion and engendered so much resistance that they got zero.
Right,
I mean,
but then Clinton, what would have happened
to get
6 months
later? 1993 and got zero. I mean, that has happened in history.
What would have happened 6 months later? I mean, what is completely definable, I mean, provable, is that if you ask for less, you will definitely not get more.
True, but the converse of that is, I mean, some people have the notion that you should always shoot the moon because you'll always meet halfway. There's some sort of there's no law of diminishing marginal utility in how much you ask for. And if I go into a job interview and say I want a salary of $1 million, it's not a given that I'm going to get $500,000. I might not get the job.
Well, yes, I don't think anybody should. I don't think President Obama should have gone in there and say, "I want $5 trillion." But it's not like the number $1.2 trillion was not known inside the White House. The problem was that President Obama picked the exact same people who were responsible for the financial crisis, the exact same Reubenites, frankly, that many of us voted for him to avoid. And they shot down inside the White House and out any voices that said $1.2, $1.3 trillion, because this is basically a physics problem. You have a certain size hole in the economy, and it's going to take a certain amount of stuff to fill it. And particularly when half of what you're looking to fill it is sort of a backdoor way of doing that, you know, in terms of tax cuts, as opposed to sort of direct spending, which is far more effective. This was really more of a function of, like, as Geithner said, that's sugar to the economy. But what they perceived as sugar was really the lifeblood for a lot of for millions of Americans.
I would characterize that internal debate about the Recovery Act a little differently than you did. I think they had a debate. They had an internal debate. Obama, it doesn't just have the Reubenites in his staff. He has other economists too. And I think at the end of the day, and I think he has on a range of issues, he has internal debates and he makes the call. So I don't just like blame Summers for X or Geithner for X. You know, Obama's the guy. If you're not going to like the policy, blame Obama.
I blame him for picking the advisors he did, but I mean, you're aware of
Christina Romer and Austin Goolsbee and Jared Bernstein on top of Summers and Geithner. He's got a range of views in there, and he likes to have people hash it out.
But you're aware of Susskind's book, right? I mean,
I am, and I've also seen lots of challenges to his factual accuracy. So I wouldn't call Susskind's book the definitive.
They've been those challenges, as far as I can tell. I've been nibbling around the edges, but all right. Well, so be that as it may. So here he goes on, and he gives us stuff. Here's one problem I still have. This is another part of his speech. Did you hear the first clip of the speech?
Yes, I did.
Okay, so you'll be able to hear this one. Let's listen to this one.
In 2001 and 2003, Congress passed two of the most expensive tax cuts for the wealthy in history. And what did it get us? The slowest job growth in half a century. Massive deficits that have made it much harder to pay for the investments that built this country and provided the basic security that helped millions of Americans reach and stay in the middle class. Things like education and infrastructure, science and technology, Medicare, and Social Security. We simply cannot return to this brand of you're on your own economics if we're serious about rebuilding the middle class in this country.
Now, let's talk about his fetish with deficits. I mean, is any of this stuff really going to resonate when he still is basically saying that the deficit is the number one problem we face?
Well, I don't think you say a deficit is the number one problem at the expense of all else. But this is an issue where I think people are going to have, you know, legitimate policy differences. I think part of our discussion is debates about what was the tactically wise thing to do. Did he make the most of the opportunity, or did he make some strategic missteps? And the issue about deficit reduction is more of a deeper, I think, policy disagreement that Obama has with a good portion of the left.
Now, wait a second, Bill. Can you name me one mainstream economist who says right now, you can include analysts from Goldman Sachs if you want in this, one mainstream economist who says that the deficit is what we should be dealing with now as opposed to stimulating the economy?
Well, I don't think Obama's saying the opposite. Obama's construct is basically, I mean, I'm not saying that Krugman agrees with everything that Barack Obama says, of course, but the basic construct of what Obama is saying is in line with what Krugman says. Upfront stimulus, long-term deficit reduction. Even the Congressional Progressive Caucus, you know, their people's budget is that.
Is 2013 long-term?
I'm sorry?
Is 2013 that far away?
I mean, 2013, what are you talking about in 2013, though?
Well, 2013 is when all those cuts are supposed to take place on the trigger. We've got the rhetoric about the government tightening its belt. We've got federal workers already working under a pay freeze that was put in place, I guess, a year ago. Honestly, is it a policy issue for him, or is this just his part of his negotiating style?
I think some of the things you're talking about there, I think some of the initial cuts that have been made as part of the debt limit deal, he had the preemptive tactic in terms of federal worker pay. I think those were tactical moves to deal with the reality of a Republican House to try to avoid worse things from happening. And again, you can criticize the tactical moves. I don't think those are things that he would have done right now if he had all the power in the world. The question of the 2013 trigger, I mean, Obama himself has said he doesn't want the trigger pulled. He wants the grand bargain that locks in both the upfront stimulus, gets something like the American Jobs Act included, and has the longer-range deficit reduction that can occur after we get out of the current economic rut. That's his ideal policy. And I'm not saying you have to like every aspect of that.
Well, that's
but I don't
worse.
Think anything that Obama's talking about is saying austerity now. He has never argued for that at all.
Well, you're not suggesting that you like the grand bargain. You don't like the idea of cutting Social Security and cutting Medicare.
Well, cutting Social Security, I don't. Medicare cuts can be, depending on what they are, can be, you know, cost savers for efficiency reasons, and or can be actual cuts and benefits that hurt seniors. So it depends on what you're talking about. You know, quote unquote.
Well, if you raise the eligibility age, that's a benefit cut.
You know, the eligibility age to me, and there's a lot of debate around this. Again, speaking for myself only here, eligibility age does not upset me as much so long as you have the Affordable Care Act. If that's not being repealed, Obama's being reelected, Supreme Court doesn't overturn it. If I'm 65 years old and I'm not eligible for Medicare until 67, and I'm not working and I can't afford health insurance, I will get subsidized health insurance under the Affordable Care Act. So I'm not left out in the cold. Now, there's still an argument that doesn't make sense fiscally for other technical reasons, so I'm not saying it's the most brilliant plan in the world, but it's not the same as gutting Medicare, shortchanging seniors. We're not talking about George Bush-style privatization with any of this stuff. So I think there's things you can say, I don't like this, I can be critical of it, it's not my ideal thing to do. It's different than betrayal of the FDR social contract.
So you don't. And what about cutting Social Security, chaining the CPI, et cetera?
I mean, I think that's a much harder thing to defend. I don't love the idea of it. I do think it's different than privatization. I mean, the benefit level.
Yeah, but is there anybody seriously who thinks that we're going to be privatizing Social Security at this time?
No, we're not.
I mean,
at
we
this
destroyed
point, no.
That.
We defeated that. But I don't think what Obama
well, yes,
talking
if you
about
chop off
the
my,
level of the kind of betrayal.
You chop
that
off my
hear.
Arm, it's better than you killing me. But I mean, I didn't know you killing me was on the table. Well, why can't I choose between you not chopping off my arm and maybe actually giving me a coat?
Well, this is something where I am a little unclear to what degree Obama is prioritizing this or just is willing to use it as a bargaining chip. I suspect he'd be very happy with a grand bargain that did not include that kind of Social Security cut. Although,
let me ask you
I think
this.
You have to say at this point,
let you go
he's willing to bargain it. He's clearly raised the subject with Boehner before, so I'm not gonna BS you and say that's totally off the table because he's clearly talking about it. But I don't necessarily think it's something that he is dying to do. But if you think that kind of change in the CPI or a change in the retirement Social Security is so horrible that it negates everything else that Obama has accomplished, then you should not support him. But I do think it bears the question. Let's look at what this specifically would do. What is the degree
I don't even
of
agree.
Badness there?
I don't,
how
listen,
does it stack up to the rest of his
listen,
agenda?
Listen, I don't even agree with what your last statement is, because I do think it's horrible. I think it's even more horrible. I don't know which is worse, the policy implications of it or the long-term narrative implications. But I don't have a choice. Chopping off my arm is better than killing me. I resent
the
fact.
You could choose to go third party. You could say that nothing has changed here. Everything is a one-party oligarchy, and the system sucks, and I'm not going to participate or vote for a third party. You have that choice.
Well, no, I mean, of course I have that choice, but I mean, you know me, Bill. Voting for me is not about self-expression. It's a very practical exercise, and unless I have a real genuine belief that a third party could win, then you know that's not necessarily a viable option for me.
So I think if that's
think,
where
let
you
me ask
are,
you this. Let me ask you this.
Well,
let
I,
me
can
ask
I pick,
you, wait,
can me that one
this.
Point quickly?
No,
can you ask me?
No, because wait a second. I want to ask you this. All right.
Okay.
Because I'll tell you something. This is why we had Bill Scherer on all the time back in the day. He's so slippery. You just don't want to be across the aisle from him. Can you tell me? You know, President Obama cited Ronald Reagan as a genuinely transformative president. He spoke probably as glowingly about Reagan as he did any president in terms of, you know, in the campaign. Do you think that President Obama has fundamentally in any way changed the American public's understanding of politics, has helped them adopt a more liberal frame, progressive frame on the way that they see things in our politics and how over the past 3 years?
I think we're on our way. I don't know if we're totally there yet. Obviously, if we didn't get reelected, that project would not come to fruition. But
over the past 3 years, can you point to like one example?
We are now back to having public investment in our country again. We are re-regulating again. We have ended the three-decade reign of deregulation. And these are concepts that the public supports. And the other piece of this big pieces that we haven't gotten yet are tax fairness, which the public supports. We just have a problem with Congress getting it done. And on the energy front, trying to, you know, cap carbon emissions and launch the green energy economy. Part, you know, there's some investment in that in the Recovery Act, but obviously the carbon cap is very critical. But these are also areas where the public agrees with the president on. You know, there's difficulties in navigating congressional
water. I get that. I mean, but I was asking what has President Obama done to change those things? Because in some respects, we've seen slippage on the idea of global warming under President Obama, at least in terms of the way the public sees it. Certainly from a policy standpoint, I'm not terribly impressed with what he's done. I mean, I don't even know why we had to contemplate Keystone. Yes?
I'm sorry, to your initial question about, you know, transforming the public's understanding, and I would dispute what you're saying about the polling on global warming. the slippage is very minor. It's still a clear majority of the country thinks global warming is a problem and thinks we should
cap carbon. Well, yes, I'm asking what he's done in the positive.
I'm telling you, and what he's done in the positive is, one, pass what he has passed, number one, and two, rhetorically, you can go back to speech after speech after speech where he talks about the value of government action. That is necessary to have government take action to solve these problems. He has not shied away from that, and he often points to what he did to save the auto industry as the quintessential example when people said the government shouldn't act, and we acted, and we saved a million jobs.
I think that was the best. I think that was one of the best things that he's done, as a president, frankly. And I wish that he would have had that same sense of urgency when it came to homeowners and whatnot. But Bill Scheer, we'll have to do this another day. Always a pleasure. Just, he's so wild.
We will
Bill
do it
Scheer.
Again. There's always more to talk about.
There certainly is. All right, Bill Scheer, ladies and gentlemen. And you can check out the Liberal Oasis podcast, right?
Liberal Oasis podcast, liberaloasis.com. Tracy Olson and I, it's a home for Obama bots nationwide.
Well, I got to say, Bill, you certainly earned your invitation to the White House today.
Oh, I hate Obama for the invitation.
I understand.
Now I get. They have the pigs in the blanket they serve there are fantastic. I can't let that go.
I understand. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Bill Scheer, thanks for joining us. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Abby Clark from OccupyOurHomes.org. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Abby Clark. She is one of the organizers of Occupy Our Homes. You can get more information at OccupyOurHomes.org. And we have a bunch of clips that we're going to be posting on our site at Majority.fm, linking to some of the stories from what happened yesterday. Welcome to the program, Abby.
Thank you so much. I'm really thrilled to be here.
How did you get involved in Occupy Our Homes? What was the behind the idea to launch it?
Well, like so many people all over the country, I was so excited when the Occupy movement started in New York. And I'm from the Midwest, and we don't have a Wall Street in Michigan, where I'm from. And so I was having so many conversations with friends that wanted to do something, that wanted to be a part of this movement, but didn't know how to bring it home and make it real in all of our communities. And we talked about it, and we talked about the banks and making sure that that was still the focus of what we were doing. And we realized that the fight is foreclosure in these communities. What's brought down our economy in so many ways is this mortgage crisis, and that this is something affecting absolutely every American all over the country, and that we could help real people in our communities if we help them fight foreclosure and stay in their homes. And it's something America needs, and it's something the economy needs.
All right. So give me a sense of just what took place yesterday.
It was truly incredible. I mean, we're just thrilled. We started talking about this literally, 6 or 8 weeks ago. And it was it was just an idea of something that could happen. And we just, I think 2 weeks ago today, the website launched, and we've been talking to people across the country. And then yesterday, there were over 40 actions across the country, thousands of people involved in dozens of different cities. In every region of the country, there were home reclamations. We moved homeless families into homes in some cities. We stood with families who are resisting foreclosure and trying to renegotiate with banks in other cities. There were disruptions of foreclosure auctions to stop people's homes from being auctioned away from them. There were rallies. There were press conferences. It was just, there were marches. It was just a really incredible, thrilling day of action.
And so how many homes at the moment are being occupied and by occupiers that are foreclosed homes, or alternatively, and maybe also, how many homes have been reclaimed for families that didn't have homes? Because these would be ongoing now projects, correct?
Right. That is the goal, to have this be ongoing. And honestly, it's sometimes hard to keep track, because there are occupations and people doing this that we're in very good touch with. But then also yesterday, things were happening in cities that we had no idea were going to happen. We found out things were happening in Boise. Things were happening in Salt Lake City that we didn't know about. So we know that there are home occupations happening in at least 40 homes.
Wow.
And I can't actually say how many of those are reclamations and how many of those are helping families who still reside in that home but are facing foreclosure stay in that home. But it's some of each.
And if we want to get more information about the specifics, in other words, if I wanted to see if there was one of those in my city and I wanted to go join, or I wanted to go support them, or I wanted to get on some type of text alert in the event that they needed my help or something, where would I go? Is there a central clearinghouse for these things?
Everyone should please go to occupyourhomes.org and sign up with us there. We are working on developing better systems to coordinate people in different locations. I love the idea of a text alert system, and that's something that we'll hopefully try to aim for. And we also have a Facebook group, Occupy Our Homes, on Facebook, so anyone can look us up there. And we have amazing groups working in a lot of places that we connect people to. So sometimes we get people contact us in smaller towns in Maine or Wisconsin that we don't have a group going yet. So as we're getting more and more people contacting us, the more people contacting us, especially offering to help, that's so wonderful, because we need everyone involved in this so that we can help more and more of these homeowners and make this a truly large-scale national movement that it deserves to be.
Now, are you doing this out of Michigan? Were you involved in any actions yesterday, or were you coordinating it from basically of the online apparatus?
There were a team of just, I think, four of us sitting in a room in D.C. trying to coordinate the online stuff to, you know, collect all the clips that were coming in, to keep people in touch with each other, to handle a lot of the communications and coordination. So I was on that team. But I'm very involved in organizing in Michigan. So we had a family in Southgate, Michigan, which is a Detroit suburb, contact us through the website last week. And I made sure that they got in touch with some wonderful organizers with Occupy Detroit and some other Michigan organizations. And we were able to have a great event at their house yesterday. They're supposed to leave their house in January, but they're going to resist, and they're trying to renegotiate with Bank of America, which they've been trying to do for years. I mean, that's just one of the really common stories is that people have tried and tried and tried to get loan modifications, and there have been mistakes. They've been ignored. So many people are employed, are hardworking, but have had health issues, have had the kind of setbacks that anyone can have. We've had so many of these really wrenching stories come in, and it's wonderful to be able to help them. And this family in Southgate, they're not, you know, radical activists. They are just regular people. They haven't been political, but now they're involved in this movement. And they, with the help of some organizers, reached out to their neighbors, reached out to their church, and a huge crowd of people came out to support them yesterday. You know, the whole yard was full of people with signs who said they're going to stand with them. So it's really amazing, and I really hope more people get involved with it.
Well, I'll tell you something. For an action that has been in the plan, has been in the planning, been planned for only 6 to 8 weeks, you certainly scared the heck out of Bank of America. An email came out. I'm sure you've seen this. An internal email,
yes.
By the Bank of America, the BAC, Bank of America Corporation Field Services, basically outlining, like, this could have an impact on our industry. Here are the things to do, and we'll get you more information, essentially, as we can. I think this is going to be, I think this is really just an incredible an incredible action to take in sort of reaching out to people who are on the front lines of suffering from the implications of this financial crisis and the malfeasance by these banks. Where can people go if they want to see some more of these individual stories? Because the ones I've seen have been absolutely heart-wrenching. The idea of a family with their kids who have an opportunity to own a home for their first time and really just need help to work out this loan in the way that any business who was in this type of situation with a bank would have the opportunity to do. And it's simply
exactly
because of the small increase in fees the bank will get. Even though they'll dump this house for a huge loss, they can push that off on somebody else. They're just looking for the fees.
It's awful. It's ridiculous that this is how this is working in our country right now. And, yeah, we're getting more and more stories, excuse me, are coming in over the website all the time, and we're rushing to keep up with posting new stories on the website, occupyourhomes.org. We love video, so that's something that if anyone took a video from an action yesterday, if anyone wants to make a video telling their story, that's something that we will absolutely use. Because you're exactly right. These banks got bailed out trillions of dollars of taxpayer money. And, you know, some people think that was a good idea. Some people don't. Regardless, nothing on that kind of scale, even remotely, has been done for regular American homeowners. And the fact is that this doesn't just affect people who have been foreclosed on and evicted. It doesn't just affect people who may be facing foreclosure, or even just people, and we're talking about millions of people who are underwater on their mortgages. This affects absolutely everyone in every neighborhood. Even people who got very responsible 30-year mortgages, nothing new or fancy, and have kept their jobs, been fortunate that they haven't struggled with a health issue or a job loss. Even those people have lost enormous amounts of money that they thought was safe because it was tied up in their home. People thought that that was their savings. And when there's a foreclosure in the neighborhood, it brings down the home values in that entire neighborhood. So it affects everyone. People need to stand with their neighbors, one, because it's the right thing to do, but also because it's in their best interest to have this stop. It's hurting everyone.
Abby Clark from OccupyOurHomes.org, thanks so much for joining us. And please feel free to pass on any active occupations of homes that are ongoing and people want to call into this program and give us an update over the coming days and weeks. We are more than we would be more than excited to talk to those people. We think what you're doing is tremendous, and keep up the great work.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, and we really appreciate the support.
All right, folks. Now we will head into our better half of the program. A couple of things. Oh, you know, I wanted to read that email. I guess I'll read it tomorrow. The email that sort of just like, I shouldn't even read emails first thing in the morning. It depressed me the whole day. But folks, if you can become a member of the Majority Report, please do. It is your membership that supports this show. So even if, I only need 40 minutes a day of podcasting, but I love what you're doing, it's really important, but I only need 40 minutes, so I'm not going to pay. You know, when you become a member, you're paying for that 40 minutes. The other stuff is just bonus material that I give you. That's what the email was, essentially. Your show is great. It's really important. We need shows like this. I just don't listen to that much, after the 40 minutes, so good luck. And I said, is this about finance? No, I can afford it, but what you're doing is really important. That's like President Obama coming out 3 years into his presidency and saying, this is wrong. And the next opportunity I get to do something about it, I'm going to do something about it. Maybe. But it's wrong. Okay, see you at the polls. Don't forget, you can buy your crap through our Amazon link, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, or chocolate. Give us a review on iTunes.
Fill out that little survey that we posted on the blog today. It's just basically our podcast host would like to see if any sponsors are interested in us.
Okay, yeah. So we'll tell you more about that. All right, we'll see you in the post show.